Welcome to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's 3:06 and you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In just a bit, we'll talk about the presidential election that took place today in Iran.
But before we do that, here's a trivia question for you. Any idea where the largest ever woolly mammoth was dug up?
If you said Kenosha, well, ding, 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 you're absolutely right. The bones were originally found on a farm back in the 60s, and they're now on display at the Milwaukee Public Museum.
That's just one of the fun facts we learned this week from a cool article called 10 Things Wisconsinites Don't Know About Wisconsin.
And that got us going on the idea of other curiosities around the state. Like, I was driving on 151 a few weeks back, going through Platteville, and if you've been there, you've seen on the side of a hill a really big M. And I know it's not M for Platteville, so that's just one of those things I wonder.
And I've always wanted to know where the goats that live on the rooftop of Al Johnson's Swedish restaurant go in the winter. I've kind of been hoping that they're not floating in a mushroom sauce on somebody's plate.
So we're launching this new segment. We're calling it Curious Wisconsin, where we're going to find the answers to the burning questions you've always had about the Badger State.
We've got Stephanie Klett, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, to help us kick things off. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Hi, Rob. And I like both the things that you pointed out, and I have answers to both.
Oh, excellent. Well, you've got answers. Well, let's start with your article first. Can you tell us a little more about this mammoth we were talking about?
Oh, sure. It is the largest woolly mammoth ever excavated. And when you think about that, that's incredible. And it was important for a lot of reasons. One, because it was so big. But the other reason is they actually found butchering marks on it. So what that tells us is that it's evidence of human habitation in North America at a time when we weren't so certain about that. So you can see it on display. They have a replica of it in Kenosha, which is a free museum, and also at the Milwaukee Public Museum, which is another fantastic place to go.
It must be pretty awe-inspiring, even in replica form.
It really is. And, you know, both of those museums are incredible for a sense of discovery, adventure, science, history. So they really bring it to life.
And then moving from really big wildlife to really small, Wisconsin has something called the Kentucky Derby of Cooties. What is that?
Well, I have had the joy of that. Now, I don't know if everyone's going to like this, but I participated many years ago in tiny little Oxbow, Wisconsin. And Oxbow isn't even on a lot of Wisconsin maps. They basically have no stoplights, population of 7. It's an unincorporated town. There's not even cell service unless you stand at the top of the hill on Highway 70. They have one little tavern. And I actually got to film it years ago, and it's a tavern/hotel/restaurant along the Flambeau River. And so we walked in, and, you know, folks told me this was some really great festival. And we walk in, and, you know, people are drinking beer and eating brats. And I thought, you know, what's the big deal? This festival I've seen before. Well, they do a little competition where they race wood ticks. And if your wood tick doesn't win its heat, the crowd yells out, "Hammer, hammer."
Oh, no.
And they kill it. And they call it, you know, wood tick population control and Lyme's disease control. But half the fun is watching people try to keep the wood tick alive and getting them, because they actually have a wood tick corral where you can buy your wood ticks. Mm-hmm. Or they encourage you to walk in the forest, because it's so thick there, you're going to end up with wood ticks on you. So you'll see people blowing into plastic bags to keep their wood tick alive, or keeping it on their body so it has the warmth and the heat that it needs.
It's hard to know where to start there. I don't know. It sounds kind of bloodthirsty, except they're wood ticks, so that's pretty much the definition of a wood tick. I'd feel bad about the squashing and the gavel and all that, but, you know, hey, I guess they're wood ticks, and it's Wisconsin.
Well, and they carry a lot of disease, and it's funny because the winner gets like a trophy, a little money, but it's really about bragging rights, and they do call it the World Championship International Wood Tick Race.
Oh, boy. Well, what about Sheboygan? That's got some surprises, right?
Well, it does. In fact, not too long ago on the Travel Channel, they did a huge thing about the top 10 places in the world to surf. And in the top 10 was Sheboygan, Wisconsin, because it's known for its freshwater surfing, some of the best in the world. And so if you want to surf And they say the peak surf season is about mid-September to March. Yes, freezing water. So it is crazy because you'll actually see people surfing with ice. It's really nuts. But they do the Dairyland Surf Classic, so it's like the national championship for freshwater fishing in the summer. And it's cool to see, or summer, late, early fall, some of the people that come in from around the world for that. So you, when you think of Sheboygan, you don't really think of surfing. And you should, because you will see the hot spot when you're in that city. And that city has really had a lot of improvements, great restaurants, museums over the last 10 years. And this is something that they have that really diversifies the experience that you'll get.
And just briefly, we know a lot of Wisconsinites are passionate about their bikes, but why is Sparta the bike capital of America?
Well, the Elroy Sparta Trail was the first rails-to-trails system in the entire United States back in the 70s. So, of course, it was an old, you know, railroad bed. But why it's so famous, it's about 32 or 34 miles, and it's a limestone, crushed limestone surface. But what makes it famous is that it has three huge tunnels that you go underneath. And the longest tunnel, and what's great is if it's 95 degrees out, these tunnels are always 55 degrees, no matter what season it is. But the tunnel's so long, you have to dismount your bike, walk it through with a flashlight, and the water is still dripping down. And when you get about a quarter way into this tunnel, you cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's really an unusual experience that very few places in the country can give you. And you're going through tiny towns like Wilton and Norwalk, Sparta, and, of course, it ends in Elroy.
And I guess we've got to leave it there, Stephanie. So much to explore in Wisconsin, so many wonderful things. And thank you for kicking off Curious Wisconsin with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Stephanie Klett is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Tourism.
And now it's your turn. Is there something you've noticed in Wisconsin that's got you curious? Well, the crack team here at Central Time is ready to help. Head on over to our Facebook page and send us your questions. And they could be featured on an upcoming Curious Wisconsin segment.
You can also call and leave a message at our Central Time toll-free hotline, 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422.
And after the break, we'll look at what's going on with Iran's presidential election. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tune into the Joy Cardine Show Monday morning at 7 to hear Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Sean Johnson update us on politics at the state capitol.
Here's Kristen Durst from our news department with a check of the latest headlines. Hey, Kristen.
Thanks, Veronica. Syria's government says the U.S. has accusations that Syria has used chemical weapons against rebel fighting against the Bashar Assad regime are lies. The Obama administration is now preparing to supply the rebels with weapons and is determining what weapons will be delivered and how the delivery will be made. 10 more homes have been found burned by what was already Colorado's most destructive wildfire. An updated list shows 389 homes destroyed as authorities continue to assess the damage from the fire near Colorado Springs. The homes were burned earlier in the Black Forest fire and have only now been surveyed. The Experimental Aircraft Association has agreed to pay the Federal Aviation Administration's $450,000 for the air traffic control services during the upcoming AirVenture fly-in. But under protest, EAA Chairman Jack Pelton says the FAA held his organization hostage by demanding the fee or causing it to cancel the popular air show. The FAA said it would bill the EAA for air traffic controllers in order to meet mandatory federal budget cuts.
Thank you, Kristen. You can catch up on more news coming up at 3:30. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
4 years ago, millions of Iranian protesters filled city streets claiming fraud after President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's reelection. Well, today, Iranians went back to the polls to elect a new president, and this time it won't be Ahmadinejad.
But that doesn't necessarily mean life and politics in Iran are necessarily going to change. With us to discuss today's elections in Iran are Flint Leverett and Hillary Mann Leverett. They're both veterans of the National Security Council and the State Department and co-authors of the book Going to Tehran. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Hillary, we'll start with you. Are these what we would think of when we think of a democratic presidential election?
Well, they're not Western
secular democratic elections the way that we do it. But there are a lot of things that are similar. For example, this is the 11th presidential election the Islamic Republic has had. They've set up, I think it's over 60,000, over 65,000 actually, polling stations across the country, including nearly 300 voting stations abroad. So there are a lot of the kind of accoutrements that we would associate with elections. The key concern that many in the United States have is that there is a guardian council that vets candidates. So over 600 people put in their hat to run for president, and out of that, the guardian council weaned the list down to about 8, and then 2 of them dropped out, leaving the remaining candidates that we have today. But it's been a very competitive campaign. The campaigns of each of these candidates have really mattered according to the polls, and I think what we'll see in terms of the voting outcome today. Each of them did state paid for documentaries, for example. There were presidential debates, 3 substantive hours-long presidential debates on television for Iranians to see, and candidates went across the country to campaign. So is it the same as our election? No, but would we recognize it as a competitive, maybe even fiercely competitive election? I think absolutely.
And Flint, it looks from what I've seen today like there's pretty high voter turnout there.
Yes.
Do the Iranian people take this pretty seriously?
Yes, I think the evidence from voter participation rates, from polls, from the best data that we have about Iranian popular attitudes, is that they do take this election very, very seriously. I mean, their turnout rate in this election is going to be higher than, it is in the United States for a presidential election by a considerable margin.
And we've had talk of the opposition to the Supreme Council, the regime in Iran. The last election, as we mentioned a few moments ago, resulted in massive nationwide protests. Where is that opposition in this election today? Let's go with Flint.
I think it's important to distinguish between opposition in the sense of people who, in some fundamental way, want to get rid of the Islamic Republic, and people who they may want the Islamic Republic to evolve in some significant ways, but at the end of the day, they still want it to be an Islamic Republic, wanted to try and combine participatory politics with Islamic government. With that latter camp, the group that wants to evolve the system, those people are called reformists, and I think those people are turning out in very hefty percentages to vote for their candidate, Hassan Rouhani. I think that the more radical opposition, they have had to struggle with a kind of strategic and tactical choice. Do they go and participate in these elections when they don't want to preserve this system, or do they go and, from their perspective, try and make the best out of a not good set of choices? But in reality, I think that the percentage of the Iranian population that wants to get rid of the Islamic Republic is actually pretty small. I don't think, you would be talking about a very, very large percentage of the population at all that wants to get rid of the Islamic Republic, to evolve it, to reform it. You'd get larger numbers there, but to get rid of it, there's not really a big constituency for that.
And looking at it from the perspective of the United States, Hillary, when we're looking at reformists or radicals who want to change the regime, that's not the same thing as saying they are particularly friendly to the United States or even really care what we think. Is that right?
Well, I think we've seen under successive Iranian administrations, whether they're more conservative, reformist, or centrist, each one of these administrations inside Iran has actually expressed interest in working with the United States on a range of issues. When I worked at the White House in the Bush administration, for example, we worked then with Iranian officials under President Khatami, a reformist president, over Afghanistan. We cooperated quite well over Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, and at the beginning on Iraq. So they're not looking for the U.S. endorsement or approval at all in their internal politics. And in fact, every time a U.S. official says something about the internal system in Iran, it is seen as quite offensive there. But that doesn't mean that they're anti-American or that they are not interested in cooperating with the United States. They have repeatedly across a wide range of administrations, whether it's Afghanistan, Lebanon, Bosnia, a range of issues.
Well, on things like foreign policy, Hillary, does the president have that much say, or is this something that goes to the ruling council and the supreme leader?
Well, this is something that, you know, I think unfortunately undergirds the American mythology about Iran, that somehow it is a dictatorship, and it's some days it's the supreme leader that rules the dictatorship, some days it's the president. It depends what we think about that president. But in reality, it's a system there that is by design a competitive system with competitive power centers, parliament, president, the supreme leader, the Revolutionary Guards, etc. And what we've seen in the history of the Islamic Republic is that each president has been, of course, loyal to the supreme leader, loyal to the system, but very consequential with a real independent agenda and constituency of his own, whether that's Ahmadinejad, whether that was Khatami, the reformist president before him, or Rafsanjani, who's considered kind of a centrist president. Each one of them had a very particular agenda that the supreme leader and the system gave them latitude to pursue. Now, when their agendas didn't work out that well or there were problems, those presidents suffered. And I think you see that by the end of their time in office, each one of these presidents, it's not just Ahmadinejad today, but Khatami and Rafsanjani previously, each one of them left office a somewhat diminished figure because they had to accept both the credit for their successes and the problems with their failures.
And Flint, I think one of the things that the White House is most interested in when they're looking at a new Iranian president is the issue of nuclear weapons development. Is that something that's going to change? Is this election a turning point on that issue?
You know, I don't think it's going to change. Even the, let's call him the centrist or reformist candidate on the ballot today, who I think has a very good chance of making at least the runoff, Hassan Rouhani, he said explicitly during his campaign that nuclear policy isn't going to change if he were to become president. You know, I think that we've spent a lot of time in Iran and talking to a range of Iranian officials, analysts, so forth. And you know, I think that what's really going on with the nuclear program is this is an effort to be independent of the United States. The Islamic Republic is determined to enrich uranium under international safeguards, which is its legal right to do. And right now it's doing that in defiance of the United States, of Israel. And that actually plays politically to its advantage. I don't believe that there's no majoritarian support in the Iranian public or among Iranian elites for actually building nuclear weapons, but having an independent nuclear capability, there's very strong support for that in Iran. And I don't think that aspect of Iran's nuclear policy is going to change.
Hillary, moving forward, you both wrote a book about how the United States should interact with Iran. Moving forward, regardless who the president is, what are your thoughts for the Obama White House and his successor, for that matter, in relations with Iran?
It's critically important that President Obama or his successor, I think it should be done as soon as possible, accept the Islamic Republic as a country, as a system that is here to stay. For 32 years, American so-called Iran experts have told us that the Islamic Republic of Iran is a system that is despised by its own population. Its economy is a disaster, and it's just ready for overthrow. But for 32 years, that has been false. It is a myth. It has been false. And what it has done is it has hurt the United States strategically in the region. You see that playing out tragically today in Syria, because each time we're looking at the Middle East, we're looking at it in zero-sum terms. How can we push back Iranian influence? How can we bring about this inevitable collapse of the Islamic Republic? To the tune of 93,000 people dead in Syria, a lot of that is about Iran, because we don't want Iran to win in Syria. Well, we had this similar experience in Asia in the 1960s and early 1970s, when we thought the same thing about China, that somehow for 20 years in the 50s and 60s, the idea was we could isolate China impose crippling sanctions and basically micromanage Asia on our own. Well, we came up with the Korea War and then the Vietnam War and tens of thousands of Americans dead until President Nixon and Henry Kissinger realized that the United States had to fundamentally change its policies in Asia and realign to the reality that the People's Republic of China was here to stay, regardless of what we thought about the internal system. A similar realignment needs to happen here. We are not going to be able to achieve any of our stated objectives in the Middle East as long as we continue to pursue a futile attempt to bring down the Islamic Republic. We need to, like with China, accept it on it for what it is and work with it. We've been able to work with it in some areas previously, like I said, my personal experience when I was at the White House on Afghanistan, but in some other areas too. We need a fundamental realignment to realize that we can work with the Islamic Republic like we do with China. Not that it's going to be problem-free, but we have to accept that it is a rising revolutionary power, fiercely independent, is not going to subordinate its interests to the United States, but that we can work with that.
Flint, in just 30 seconds or so, do you think that the political will is there in the United States to make that kind of change?
I hope I'm wrong, but as an analyst, I have to say I don't think that political will is there yet.
And
that's unfortunate because it's time for the United States to do this.
Thank you both so much for joining us today on Central Time.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Flint Leverett and Hillary Mann Leverett. They're co-authors of the book Going to Tehran.
Next, it's a look at state news, and then we'll check in with WPR reporter Mike Simonson about the protests happening at a proposed mining site in northern Wisconsin.
You may have noticed this is our second pilot of Central Time, and we want to know what you think. Go over to the Central Time Facebook page or send us an email, listener@WPR.org. Advice on how to develop the show moving forward, we're really interested in your feedback. Central Time Facebook page or listener@WPR.org.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's been a bit more than 3 months since Governor Walker signed a controversial mining bill into law. And tensions are still running high in northern Wisconsin between those who worry the proposed mine will damage the Lake Superior watershed and the mining company, GTAC.
We want to give you a chance to sound off on the mining issue. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 and let us know how you're feeling about it.
But first, the Lakota Ray tribe is now trying something new to stop an iron ore mine from being built in the Pinoki Hills. They've set up a harvest camp, and it's right in the middle of the proposed mining site. Wisconsin Public Radio's Mike Simonson has this report from the camp.
Connor Bolio of LCO says he's almost 13 years old and proud to show off his new camp.
We're building a little wigwam right there, and right here is where one of our campers are staying. Pretty nice here. Peaceful. I don't know where this leads, but let's explore.
The 5-acre camp is tucked away in an Iron County forest. There's no cell phone service here, but there are campsites, trails, wigwams, a community kitchen, and lots of young people. 12-year-old Mikey Demain of LCO likes working at the camp.
Yeah, I help him make some wigwams, help collect firewood, stack it. I think I'm going to hang out there a lot this summer.
Mikey's grandfather, Paul Demain, says this is also an educational camp.
You can learn about mushroom gathering, plant medicines, wigwam building. There's people fishing. There are people doing all kinds of beautiful things, and it is so healing. And that's ultimately, I think, what it was. The idea says, how can we help mend our communities and come together?
The camp is on top of the largest iron ore body in North America, with the potential to create hundreds of jobs. But Wisconsin tribes say it would destroy this pristine land. So this spring, the Lakota Ray Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe Governing Council voted to designate this spot as a harvest camp. They have that right under the Treaty of 1842 to hunt, fish, and gather. The treaty ceded the land to the U.S. government in exchange for that right. LCO elder Melvin Gasper says Native American harvest camps date back centuries when tribes lived off the land.
You start out with the spring camp of the maple sugar camp. You would travel next to your fishing camp. Then you'd travel next to your harvest camp of harvesting your wild game and stuff for the winter. And then you would have your winter camp.
And Gasper says there's another reason. It's to stop the mine. DeMaine says the mine would poison the Lake Superior and Bad River Reservation watersheds, so it's time other tribes join the fight.
If there's people from some indigenous nation who has relationships to land up here and occupy the range, that's up to them. What we've tried to do is establish a legal framework in which we can exist there and coincide with what's there now and monitor the situation.
DeMaine says LCO is deliberately getting in the way of Gogebic Taconite, which is currently drilling exploratory boreholes.
Bad River seemed to be taking the brunt of the battle on this mining legislation and organizing it. And frankly, people get tired and they feel beaten up at times, and so there's other tribes who are saying, how could they contribute to this way?
So they've built this harvest camp. Elder Gasper says even as they pull wild onions from the ground, they are effectively occupying this area.
Most definitely it is. They were asking us basically, how do you protest? It's a brand new way. It's a peaceful manner in which we're using it as a harvest area. Show them what can be taken out of this and saved. Some of us just given our whole lives for this, you know, to fight the cause to stop the mining.
Gasper says his ancestors sacrificed for him. Now he's doing the same for Mikey and Connor and future generations. Mike Simonson, Wisconsin Public Radio at the LCO Harvest Camp in Iron County.
And we want to know what you think about this mining issue. Give us a call and tell us your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We'll be taking those calls in just a bit. And Mike Simonson joins us now from Wisconsin Public Radio Studio in Superior. Mike, welcome to the show.
Very cool. Thanks.
Well, Mike, set the scene for us. What's happening on the ground around this mining site?
Well, it's been a very unusual week and perhaps violent. We don't really know because we're getting a lot of spin from both sides. The GTAC calls it Al-Qaeda-like eco-terrorism, and the sheriff is taking a little cooler approach. The Iron County District Attorney, I was just on the phone with him not 10 minutes ago, and he'll be pressing charges, but he's not sure if it'll be simple theft, vandalism probably, but whether it'll be assault or not. But there was an action or raid, depending on what side you're on, at the drill rig site at about 9:30 on Tuesday morning. 8 to 12 activists from Action Camp, which is not from the LCO Harvest Camp, different philosophies and how this works. And they confronted drill workers. Drill workers say it was profanity, they were scared, and there was some vandalism. So that wasn't completely unexpected because there was a civil disobedience training last month for these folks.
So some violence possibly there. We don't know. Sounds like there's lots of stories to untangle. And wasn't the First Lady of Wisconsin, Jeanette Walker, in the area recently as well?
Yeah, she got a look at Copper Falls State Park. But, you know, and it's a gorgeous area, and a snake came around, and that kind of startled her. But she really was, you know, I don't think she's got anything that she can say to the governor. The legislative process is over on this, and now it's pretty much going to be the DNR permitting and the federal government, which is going to be a big deal. The interesting thing with this LCO Harvest Camp is they're taking, besides it being educational camp, they're acting as occupiers, except instead of like the Occupy movement, they may have a legal right, and they say they do have a legal right to be there, and it is on the mining site. So the mining company eventually, if they get permitted, would have to evict them in an area that they have should have legal access to.
Now, the legal right being what? This treaty from 1842, is that right?
Yeah, to hunt, fish, and gather in the ceded territory. They gave up the land for payments from the U.S. government with the agreement, and it's a treaty, and treaties are laws of the land between two sovereign nations, which tribes are, that they can hunt, fish, and gather in the territory they ceded to the U.S. government.
Now, Mike, we've got about 30 seconds. What do you see happening next? What are you watching most closely?
is going to be a walk tomorrow. It's going to be through the woods, a 6-mile round trip. I couldn't do it. There's too many mosquitoes out there. But I think there's going to be a lot of small actions. I guess I'd be surprised. I mean, they're going to drill a total of 9 holes. This is just the first one. So it could be a hot summer for the next several weeks.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Mike Simonson is WPR's reporter based in Superior. And now it's your turn to sound off. What do you think of the plans to mine iron ore in northern Wisconsin? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
Coming up after the break, we'll take your calls, and then we'll check out a new exhibit opening today at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's called 30 Americans. It'll explore what it means to be a contemporary artist and an African American. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Monday afternoon at 3, it's At Issue. John Munson's guest talks about the CIA's new role in the way America wages war against terrorist groups.
Right now, here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon from Kristen Durst. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Rob. The both sides in Syria's civil war are getting some pledges of support today. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah group is vowing to keep fighting alongside Syrian government troops where his fighters are needed. And the United States will be working out the details of the weapons it will be providing to Syrian rebels. The House has passed a sweeping $638 billion defense bill imposing new punishments on military members found guilty of rape or sexual assault. The White House has threatened to veto the legislation because it blocks President Barack Obama from closing the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and limits his ability to reduce nuclear weapons. State Department of Natural Resources Board is poised to adopt kill limits for Wisconsin's second wolf hunt later this month at a meeting in Wausau. State's Wolf Advisory Committee has recommended a statewide quota of 275 animals. That's up from 201 for the first season last year.
Thanks, Kristen. We'll hear more news coming up at 4 o'clock. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We just spoke to WPR's Superior reporter Mike Simonson about protests against the proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin. And now, let's take your calls on the issue.
It's an old-fashioned sound-off. You have about 30 seconds to share your thoughts. And Judy and Nina, Judy, you are on the air, and you can start us off. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I would just like to voice my opinion, and that is I am very much against the iron mine. I think after all the studies and everything I have read that it is going to end up poisoning the water. It is going to poison any water taken for wells as well as streams and rivers, and it eventually will lead into Lake Superior. Water is a precious resource, and the entire area is very precious and wild and beautiful. And I think an open pit iron mine is a very big mistake.
Judy, thank you so much for your call. We'll go now to Chris in Wausau. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. Hey, listen, I think that the Lacouturier camp was a great chess move on their part. I laughed when I heard the story. I think that putting an iron ore mine up there would be devastating to the environment. I think a couple hundred jobs to lose is a small price to pay for saving the water and nature up there. And I think that that loophole that they found was a great way to try to stop it or at least delay it, you know. So it was a great way for them to do it.
Great. And thanks a lot for your call, Chris. Time for one more call from Brandy in Portage. Brandy, hi.
Yes, hi. See, I agree with the last caller. I think it's a temporary band-aid that Walker's coming up with for just 200-300 jobs and maybe 20 years of jobs, and it'll contaminate and destroy the environment. Tens, twenties, maybe even centuries. We don't know what the outcome is going to be. And I'm very happy that the American Indians have found that not a loophole but a law that will uphold their rights to the land. This brings a whole new realm to the thought of being an Indian giver, where the white man will say, here, you can have it, unless we find a better idea.
Great. Thank you all so much for your calls. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Today, the Milwaukee Art Museum opens its 30 Americans exhibit, which showcases contemporary African-American artists.
The exhibit features works from the Rubel family collection. It highlights issues of race and identity.
Joining us now is Brady Roberts, Chief Curator of the Milwaukee Art Museum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you're director of the art museum there, and I've seen a lot of excitement about this exhibit over there, by the way.
I'm actually the chief curator, but thank you for the promotion.
Chief curator. Okay, great. No, I was going to say your museum director there said this is vastly different from anything that the museum has done in recent years. How so?
Well, this is the most important contemporary exhibition we've done in years, and it's actually one in which we're reaching out to the community in new ways. So this exhibition, 30 Americans, is drawn from the Rubel Collection, one of the most prominent contemporary art collections in the United States. All of the artists in the exhibition are African American. So we formed a task force about 6 months ago to help us reach out to the African American community and connect this exhibition as much as we could in Milwaukee. And one of the offshoots of that was a parallel exhibition, Wisconsin 30, with 30 African-American artists in our state that runs down the Schrader Galleria, right parallel to the gallery where 30 Americans is presented. And we're also having a free weekend this weekend, 10 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday, where people can come and enjoy the exhibition for free.
Now, how does this 30 Americans exhibit and the parallel one you mentioned, Wisconsin 30, fit into the overall mission there at the museum?
Well, our mission is to show great works of art and to educate and explain people what we're presenting. And what you'll see in this exhibition is a survey of some of the most important contemporary art from the past 40 years. And all of the major trends in contemporary art, abstract, representational, minimal, conceptual, new media, installation art, street art, deconstruction, they're all presented here by very important and influential artists. But there's another layer, and that is race and identity, because all of the artists are African American.
Now, our producer, KP Whaley, stopped by the pre-tour of the show, and he was blown away just by the visual impact. Can you paint us a picture, if you will, of what we see when we walk into the first gallery of your exhibit?
So even from outside of the gallery looking in, the first thing that you'll see is a big neon sign, and it's white letters with black outline. It says America. And as you watch this sign, it sort of flickers on and off, and it kind of reminds you of a store that might be going out of business. So it's like something's not quite right in America. And that's Glenn Ligon, who's one of the very well-known artists in the exhibition, who uses text in a way that makes you think about what he's saying by the way he's saying it. You'll also see on the sides, either side of this wall, you can see back in long vistas. So you'll see a Nick Cave sound suit, another artist who's getting international attention right now. He creates these fabulous sculptures that are actually costumes that people wear and dance in to music that he composes. So it's like a sculpture that's also related to performance art. You'll see a wall with Kara Walker cutout silhouette work that's 40 feet long. You'll see an enormous abstract painting by Mark Bradford. These are all very well-known artists in the contemporary art world. They're all African-American artists, and they have powerful things to say in their works of art.
Now, I'm probably like a lot of people. When I hear art museum, I think a bunch of paintings along a wall. And from what you've been saying, it's a lot more than that going on. Talk about the different media in this exhibit.
Right. So, you know, contemporary art in general is pretty wide open in terms of media. So there are painting sculptures. You'll see video screens. You'll see them on the wall. You'll see one that's closer to the floor that is documenting the performance artist William Pope L., who does crawls. He's dressed in a Superman suit, and he's crawling through Manhattan. And he started doing this in the 1970s when homelessness was on the rise. And he said, you know, you have vertical people, the upwardly mobile people, and then you have horizontal people, and Superman isn't flying anymore. And to demonstrate this, he crawls for miles through Manhattan. And so this is a very kind of visceral arrangement and display. We have sculptures made out of clothing. There's one enormous sculpture. It's about 10 feet long, 8 feet tall, and about 3.5 feet deep. And it's all cotton bales that are in the form of big cubes that are stacked. And it looks like a giant minimalist sculpture, but of course it speaks to the plantation economy that was run by slaves who had to do the hard manual labor of picking and baling cotton. so that's where these things operate on different levels. This sculpture by Leonardo Drew is very beautiful. It's very textural. It looks sort of neutral because it's just pale white, but it's very loaded with content and with the weight of history.
And that's interesting. These are all contemporary artists, but it sounds like a walk through American history at the same time.
Yeah, there are very powerful chapters in history, although, you know, some of the artists are very direct in what they're presenting, and some are very nuanced. One of the most direct works is by Gary Simons. It's called Duck, Duck, Noose, which is a take on the game Duck, Duck, Goose, where sort of the odd man is out who doesn't get a seat when the music stops. And here you have an arrangement of stools, and on every stool is a KKK hood, and in the center is a noose, and it's an actual noose hanging from the ceiling. And it speaks to the arbitrary nature in which African Americans were picked to be lynched.
Now, when I hear you talk about these exhibits, obviously very serious, intense stuff, and a lot of the artists, it sound like, are taking, I don't know if playful is the right word, but this, they're kind of playing with a way to jar us about the concepts they're exploring?
You know, there are 30 artists in the show, and I would say there are 30 different takes on what it is to be African American. And last night, Hank Willis Thomas spoke at the museum, and he didn't give a conventional lecture. He started by talking to individuals. There are about 200 people there. And he would single out people and he'd say, "Madam, you with the red shirt on, I'm just curious, why are you here this evening? What interests you?" And then he would refer to people in that way, and someone asked him, "How do you want to be referred to? Do you want to be called black or African American?" And he said, "How about calling me a person?" And he said, "You know, there are no black people and there are no white people. Have you ever seen anyone who looks white? Our building is white. You don't see anyone who's white. You don't see people who are black. So why even go there?" And, you know, that's his position, and that's a very interesting one. A lot of the artists wouldn't feel the same way. So there isn't one homogeneous, you know, message that they are collectively delivering. It's 30 positions on a very complex set of circumstances.
And how were all those artists chosen to fit into the exhibit?
So Don and Mira Rubel are among the best-known contemporary art collectors in the United States. They started in the late 1960s, way before it was fashionable. They've amassed a collection of thousands of works and established basically their own private museum in Miami. And they've done thematic shows for years. I remember seeing an exhibition of Leipzig School painters about 8 years ago that really heralded the coming of the Leipzig Painting School. So they decided, looking at their collection, that they could do a survey of contemporary African-American art. And they started working with the artists, and they brought them together and had a lot of meetings with them and said, you know, how are we going to frame this thing? What are we going to call this exhibition? And it was Rashid Johnson who said, let's call it 30 Americans. So it's, again, that's a more nuanced approach to the title.
And I don't want to let you go without talking a little more about the parallel exhibit you mentioned, the Wisconsin 30. Talk about that a little.
Yeah, so it's really the same idea. I mean, it's a snapshot of what's going on in the state. We had people who were on our community task force helped us assemble the exhibition. We have some artists who are really on the rise in this state, like Tiana Bowie, who's a printmaker who actually transcends the medium. She's teaching at MIAD here in Milwaukee, and she does large-scale collage print paintings. Reggie Baylor is another very successful Milwaukee artist who I think is about to burst out onto the national stage, and he has a beautiful painting. He also created a work that interacts with the ribs in our Calatrava building. So it's very much like 30 Americans, where you have a variety of media, a lot of different positions representing 30 individual artists and their views.
You know, that's interesting, because I often think of, you know, the art world lives in New York and San Francisco and Europe and places not here. Wisconsin has an art scene.
It does. I mean, Milwaukee increasingly is becoming a creative economy. There are some interesting things happening with a lot of restaurants opening in the downtown area, people who are classically trained chefs coming back because it's an affordable, kind of very hip city, and you feel a sort of energy right now where a lot of creative people in different disciplines are saying, hey, Milwaukee in the 21st century has become a pretty interesting place, and it's nice to be surrounded by natural beauty and not have the super high costs and the heavy traffic of major cities. So I think nationally, Milwaukee's a pretty well-kept secret.
Now, in just less than a minute, if I'm a ordinary person like me, I don't know a ton about art. Is this going to be pretty approachable? I walk in the door, I'm gonna get what's going on here?
Well, I'll tell you, it's visually dazzling. You can appreciate this exhibition purely on an aesthetic level. It's absolutely spectacular. We have text panels that give a sort of paragraph summary of each work, so it gives you a little more introduction into what the artist is thinking about. We have an audio guide where you can listen to our curator of American art, William Rudolph, and Shalene Green, who's a professor at UWM, talk in more depth about each work in the exhibition. And then we have catalogs for sale in the gift shop. So as deep as you want to go, we provide the information. But I'll tell you, it's an absolutely spectacular exhibition. This is the only venue in the Midwest, the Milwaukee Art Museum. So this is the opportunity to see this great contemporary art show.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Brady Roberts, chief curator of the Milwaukee Art Museum. We've been talking about the exhibit 30 Americans, which opens there today.
This weekend is Community Weekend at the Milwaukee Art Museum, so admission is free for everyone on Saturday and Sunday. Next is the news, and then we'll speak with Hank Willis Thomas, an artist featured in the 30 Americans exhibit. We just heard a little bit about the talk he gave, and we'll be hearing more from him in a moment. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.